the J-Talk Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the J-Talk Podcast. Ben Maxwell and Sam Robson with you. And Sam, another big weekend in the top flight, but we're leading off this week's episode with some big news from abroad.
Yes, we are. Congratulations to Ange Postecoglou and especially the J-League players that have lifted the title over there in Scotland. A great double in a first season that was incredibly difficult when he first joined, but they've done incredibly well. So, yeah, it's great to share in that glory because I think, us at the J-League can definitely have a little bit of pride in the achievements of Celtic this season.
Yes, most definitely. All right, so we're joined by not one, but two guests with huge interest in this story of not only Yokohama F. Marinos and Ange Postecoglou, but also Glasgow Celtic as well. Let's welcome in one of our regulars first, Stuart Woodward. Welcome back to the pod. How are you?
Oh, very well, thank you. Thanks. Nice to be back.
Terrific to be speaking with you again, Stuart. And I was surprised to find out in the green room that this is this gentleman's first appearance on the podcast, the main pod, J-Talk. But of course, recently we launched the Tricolour Pridecast, and one of the head honchos of that operation is Jamie McCourt, and he is indeed boots on the ground in Glasgow. Jamie, welcome to J-Talk. How are you?
I'm very well, mate. Thank you for having me, and it's a pleasure to be here.
Fantastic. Well, let's come straight back to you, Jamie. As you are well aware, it's an incredible achievement by Ange Postecoglou to win the league with Celtic in his first season at Parkhead. You were there to see them lift the trophy over the weekend. Could you believe your eyes? Could you believe that in the space of one season or 11 months at the helm, Ange has taken the team from where they were when he took over to back to the top of the mountain?
No, I can't really believe it. To tell you the truth, this whole season has been a bit unbelievable. So many times in a group chat with the guys who I met, most of them following Yokohama F. Marinos, we're all kind of having these pinch yourself moments every week or two when you're leaving the stadium and you realise that a Celtic team coached by Ange Postecoglou, containing three or four players from the J-League are kind of on their way to the title. It's been pretty bizarre, but very welcome, I must say, and especially given the size of the job he took on last year, the scale of the turnaround required. It's been a huge surprise.
So you were there in 2019, as Stuart reminded me. You're probably one of the only people in the world, if not the only one, who was there when Ange saw his F. Marino side lift the J1 title in 2019, and you were there over the weekend to see Celtic lift the title yet again, but in Ange's first season in charge. So you knew all about the coach when he took over. How much convincing of your mates did you have to do? How many doubters were there in your immediate sphere of influence of Celtic fanatics who were scratching their head at who this guy was?
Just after Ange was appointed, I was provided the nickname The Prophet on the fact that I predicted Ange would get this job on the 21st of February 2021. A gang of mates were talking about who could get the job, and I noted that the best football team I'd watched in person in the past 5 years was Ange's 2019 Marinos team. I flew over, as you mentioned, for the last two games of the season in 2019, and the first game I went to was the Kawasaki Frontale away game, which is a 4-1 victory, and whilst I'd watched them on TV the whole season, it wasn't until I saw them in person that I realised quite how good a team he'd managed to build in quite a short time, and just the speed at which they played at. I'm fortunate enough to watch some good teams in Europe at Celtic Park over the recent years, but I was really blown away by how good they were. And especially the following week as well, winning against FC Tokyo, I came away from that trip really, really impressed. And when the former Celtic manager Neil Lennon left his post, I kind of just had a feeling that before the Eddie Howe stuff started, before the rumours and his contact with the club started, I just thought Ange maybe would be a good fit. So it's one of those rare instances following football where I've managed to get something right. In terms of my kind of immediate sphere of influence, I'm actually of the belief, to tell you the truth, that it's a little overstated how maybe how much the Celtic fans weren't sure of who he was. I think I don't think there was a general understanding of his style and you know who he was individually, but I think people were generally quite open to it. As you'll know, and as maybe a lot of listeners will know, Glasgow is kind of quite a tribal city when it comes to football. And what you tend to find is that when one side of the city say one thing, the other side of the city kind of respond in turn. And I'm simplifying things massively there, but the minute the Rangers fans started laughing at the appointment of Ange, which I think was fair to say happened, Celtic fans got behind them and started rallying sort of in his favour. So yes, I think there was some uncertainty around who he was, but pretty much within a few weeks. And once he was unveiled as well in his initial press conference, I think he put a kind of a good marker down there that he wasn't someone who was going to kind of take a back seat from this. He was going to face it head on and make his mark, certainly. So yeah, I think he's done great in this first season, but I think people are willing to give him a chance. I think it's fair to say that.
And yeah, so when he took over, Sam, obviously you were bombarded with podcast guest requests and interviews and stuff from over in Scotland. Obviously Scott McIntyre and Dan Orlowitz were in a similar boat, and I guess you probably had to do quite a bit of convincing yourself. Having watched from afar this season, it's pretty hard to fathom how quickly he's turned things around. But there's one thing I guess we all knew that he was going to do, and that was that he was going to stick to his principles. And, there's a lot of people who support other clubs in Scotland listening to this that probably are, a bit squirmish at the fact that, we have to talk about this. But at the same time, you can't help but, just respect the way he goes about things, and that he's got results over there so quickly. It's just been absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah, it has been. Like everything, you would always press to everyone who was asking him. You said he's got his way of playing. He is going to follow that. You just have to believe in him. You just have to follow him. And it might be a little rocky in moments. It might take a little while. I even thought maybe this whole first season might be just a rebuilding one, and you might have to wait until the next season. But I think he said it himself that he managed to do a rebuild and a title win in one season, which was pretty unfathomable. They had a little bit of a dodgy start to the season. Obviously, they had so many players leave the club. They were still rebuilding. They had those European playoffs that came almost instantly, and he had to try and manage that. And yeah, they didn't get off to the greatest start, but it just seems from afar, at least, that everyone kind of got behind the way he was playing. They all bought into it. The players that he brought in all fitted that system perfectly. And Celtic, it was a bit of a concern. Would they fully back him in the transfer window? Would they allow him to go and sign whoever he wants? And obviously, with the players that he brought in, they allowed him to bring in Kyogo, who probably nobody would have heard of before. He did fantastically. And other players like Jota and Abada. And then they had that belief then to go on and then make those signings in January. And now it looks like he's got the crux of a really good Ange Postecoglou team. I mean, the changes there have been magnificent. And full credit to him for the way that he's turned it around. And it was great to see the Celtic support really get behind him, because, I know about this tribalism from I'm technically on the Celtic side via Twitter, and I just hear all the nonsense that comes across from Celtic and Rangers fans going at each other. So, that's not been the greatest part of this season, but it has been great to see Ange do so well, and the players that Kyogo especially has done fantastically.
Yeah, most definitely. I'll tell you what, we'll come to Jamie on his thoughts on the four Japanese players shortly. But I mean, Stuart, you're obviously a massive fan of Ange when he was in charge of F Marinos, and I guess I presume due to your friendship with Sean Galbraith and also Jamie, you might have been Celtic leaning. If I'd have asked you what your favourite Scottish team was before even Ange took over. But how have you found following the Celtic season from afar? I mean, I know they get a lot of mentions in our Patreon only line group, so I'm sure you're in other line groups and other chat rooms as well, talking about Celtic on a fairly weekly basis. So how good has that been for you this season to, I guess, kind of adopt another club?
Well, I have to say that Jamie's been working on me since day one. And after we went to, 2013, we were at Todoroki and saw Shunsuke, didn't clinch the title at that match, the famous kind of Marinos bottling. So almost the next day or next couple of days later, we were at the National Stadium. And I was in my Celtic shirt there to watch Tokushima. and some of my relatives in Scotland, because my mother's was from Aberdeen, and I have cousins living in Inverness, in Glasgow as well. So I had messages from them. Why are you wearing a Celtic shirt? Because they were, I think, Hearts fans, and so I think I've been disowned by my family now for following Celtic. And that was like about, I don't know, how many years ago was that? That's almost 10 years ago now that started. But yeah, I was, you know, hearing from Jamie how Celtic were going on, and especially last year, you know, how things kind of panned out. And but as soon as we got the announcement that Angie was in line for the job, and as soon as his name came up, we were pretty sure that he was going to get it, and he would take it. At that time, we got calls from a Scottish newspaper to talk about Marinos, and because they wanted to know, you know, about Angie and what we felt about it. So from day one, we've been, you know, watching him, and I joined up with Celtic TV and watched all the matches, some of them a little bit delayed, like the 3 o'clock in the morning ones. So I'd watch it 7 o'clock in the morning, trying to avert my eyes from the score. But it's been a fantastic year, especially because of all the people, you know, we knew what he was going to do. Like, we knew the way he was going to play, and you could see how that developed. And it was like, you know, watching, you know, 2019 Marinos again, because they're doing the same moves, people in the same position, and you could figure it out and see how it worked. And as you said, like Europe, it didn't really pan out, and they had good matches where they lost, and difficult times there. But now it's all come back, you know, much more strongly, and especially the last few weeks have been, you know, really, really great. And as we knew, there's going to be really high scoring matches in some of these matches, because once you get past a couple of goals, then the psychological thing takes in, and if you've got no possession, then, you know, people give up and let in a few more, as we've seen on several occasions. So it's been very, very fun watching it for us, and we were very sad, really sad to watch it going. But we have our own little group, the people who support both Marinos and Celtic, and so we have a good laugh with the comments and during the matches as well. So yeah, I've been enjoying it very much.
Yeah, that's absolutely brilliant. And both of our guests are absolutely buzzing still, I'm sure, after the title was clinched last midweek and the trophy was lifted over the weekend. So yeah, Jamie, what of the four Japanese players that have gone over to sign for Celtic and have all made an impact? Obviously, Yosuke Idiguchi, the least of the four. He's had a lot of injury problems since he went over to the club. So I'm sure the supporters will be looking for more from him next season. But obviously, the first signing was Kyogo Furuhashi, and I guess, you know, Celtic supporters who didn't know who Ange Postecoglou was, well, they had absolutely no idea whatsoever who Kyogo Furuhashi was. But I think it's safe to say that he won them over especially quickly, and that will have obviously paved the way for the signings of Reo Hatate and one of your old favourites at F. Marinos, Daizen Maeda, once they made the move over. So yeah, the impact, I guess, on the big three, will excuse Itaguchi for now and hope for more from him next season. But I mean, the three main players have undoubtedly had a massive impact on Celtic's season.
Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned kind of Kyogo, and you're right, you know, straight off the bat, you know, an amazing first impression. I think what it kind of, well, there's two things to Kyogo signing for Celtic, and I think one of the things that Ange is very good at, and as Sam mentioned and Stuart mentioned separately, that Glasgow is can be a bit manic, certainly online, and you know, football supporters can kind of be at each other all the time. One thing that Ange does really well in that environment is he just seems to kind of calm everything down a little bit. He seems to just kind of bring everything from a 10 just down to a kind of manageable level, and he doesn't really buy into the sort of hyperbole in the press. He's quite quick to shut down things that he feels are kind of questions that are going in the wrong direction, that sort of stuff. And to talk about Idiguchi quickly off the bat, I think that's going to benefit him in the long run, because I think he takes a very slow approach to bedding players into the team. And last summer, when Celtic signed Kyogo, they also signed Georgios Giakoumakis at roughly the same time. And Giakoumakis had finished the previous season as the top goal scorer in the Eredivisie. And I kind of had a feeling that Kyogo may have played on the left, or sort of played just off a striker potentially. But it became quite apparent quite quickly that he was going to end up being the main man. And playing that 4-5-1, I wasn't really sure if we would rotate or how it would go. But effectively, Kyogo has become the focal point of our attack. And later on in the season, when Kyogo was injured, Giakoumakis has done really well. But I think the sort of second thing being his home debut against Dundee in August last year, his home league debut, I should say. There was a point he was kind of chasing a bit of a lost cause. Defender had the ball and was kind of just about to clear it up the park, and Kyogo makes this 20-yard sprint into the corner to shut him down, slides about 4 yards and knocks the ball out for a throw-in. And when he does it, the place just erupts and goes crazy. And I think he maybe at that point there realised he's onto something, because obviously that being his game, he's all action, all energy, closing players down. He scored a hat-trick in that game. And he was still charging around, with 20 minutes to go, trying to close down defenders as they're making clearances up the park. So, I think straight away, that sort of fan-friendly playing style, people can really get behind that. They see that effort. And the thing that's really got me as well is his movement. Ange had mentioned when he first signed Kyogo, what was it about him? And I think he said it was one of the defenders at Yokohama F Minor, so it must have been either Thiago Martins or Hatanaka. They both said when they come off the park playing against Kobe that he was a nightmare to play against because they never knew where he was. His movement was really dangerous. So that's good that in some way or another one of the Marinos boys has benefited Celtic. I think the fee was quite high. I think at the time there's a lot of eyebrows raised, but my goodness, £4.5 million looks like an absolute snip at this point. And with that first season under his belt, coming back really as the main man up front next year, I'd be really excited to see what he can do in Europe, because I think that will be a big test for him, and obviously it's going to be great for his development, both for Celtic and for the national team. And on Saturday, when Celtic players were coming out at the end of the game to receive the trophy, the club played the Champions League anthem over the speaker, because we have qualified for the group stages for next year. And you could see Kyogo kind of like putting his hands over his face with sort of excitement. So I'm really looking forward to seeing how he fares there next year. With regards to Daisa Maeda, I'm sure it's been touched on in the pod before, but Maeda's the second signing that Ange has ever made, having been a former player. So he's never signed that. He's only ever signed one former player before when he's moved to a different club. And I think it was an older gent when he was in Australia managing the A-League around 15, 20 years ago. It was quite surprising for me personally when he went back for Maeda. I've always thought Maeda was a good player, and certainly his goal-scoring exploits last year were outstanding. But I was quite surprised when he went back for him. And he's another player that has totally surpassed my expectations of him. I wasn't sure where he would play. Would he play on the left? Would he play through the middle? But he's predominantly played through the left, and he's totally turned that position into his own. Even on Saturday there, he was absolutely outstanding playing on the left, and his link up play is really strong. And again, another guy who's just a willing winner, who will close down and who will really impact the game even when we're not on the ball. So it's another guy, and I'm really happy for him on a personal note as well, because I know that he'd been in Europe before and things hadn't worked out. So it's great to see him come back and really make his mark second time around. With regards to Hatate, I think that guy just needs a break for a few weeks at this point. He came in and absolutely set the league on fire. For the first three or four games, he was outstanding. And I think everybody was kind of looking at him going, how have I managed to get this guy for £1.5 million? Scored a couple of goals against Rangers, scored against Hearts at Tynecastle, which is a notoriously difficult fixture. And all the while, just looked as if he was so comfortable in there already. And another guy whose movement is so dangerous, he just seems to float into these positions in between the lines where he kind of takes the ball in kind of tight situations and lets it go, and is really clever. He's a wee bit more less sort of tactically, he's less structured. He, as I say, he floats a wee bit, and he does take risks. You know, I'd imagine his pass completion rate is pretty low in comparison to some other players in midfield, because he does try to sort of break the lines, and he's not afraid to take those risky passes on. He was outstanding for maybe 3-4 weeks, but I think it's fair to say, and Sam, if you've been watching as well, I'm sure you like, he sort of fell away after a few weeks, and then he's sort of came back and the press and sort of noted that he's had a long season before coming here, and that he was exhausted and that sort of stuff. So another player with a good break this summer. I'm really expecting to see more from him next year, and hopefully he kind of really makes that position his own. And just one thing before I finish up on that, and I think, but again, for Ida Gucci, I think he's had that bad injury in January. Celtic play 60 games a season, you know, maybe not next year because we're straight into the Champions League, but Celtic generally will play between 50 and 60 games a season, because we tend to compete in all domestic competitions until roundabout completion or semi-finals or, you know, that sort of thing, as well as in Europe, certainly in the past few years through qualifiers. That means there's a lot of squad rotation, and you know, we've had a couple of midfielders leave this weekend, so I'm expecting to see quite a bit of Ida Gucci, as I say, going forward next season, once he's recovered from his injuries and gets an opportunity in the first team. Overall, it's been a huge success, sort of plundering the G League for players, and certainly is something I would hope the club would do again in the summer.
Do you think there's been any, from other clubs in Scotland, do you think they have seen how well these Japanese players have done and are themselves looking towards the J-League? We'd imagine that Ange would probably keep his eye on the J-League to maybe bring in one or two more, but do you think other teams might be looking in that direction as well?
Honestly, Sam, they would be mad not to. If you recall, I think it was for about a season, a couple of years ago, Hearts signed Ryotaro Mishino on loan from Manchester City. And he did, you know, he did okay, I think, but nothing, never really kind of pulled up any trees. And having seen the success that Celtic have had signing Japanese players, I think they would be mad not to. And again, the thing about this is the fees involved. I've always been really frustrated following Japanese football, and I'm sure others have as well, that the fees that players leave for is scandalous at times, you know. Furuhashi being about the only one you could sort of point at and say that seems like a fair fee, but the amount of money that Celtic have paid for Maeda, you know, and even for Ida Gucci, I think it was less than £1 million or so for Ida Gucci. You know, you're getting international quality football players who are technically very gifted and evidently capable of playing in Scotland for next to nothing, you know, in real terms. So I think to answer your question, clubs would be mad not to look overseas, especially certainly to Japan, this transfer window.
Well, yeah, Sam, actually, I was just about to ask you if you'd had any contact from, I don't know, maybe some supporter podcasts from other clubs in Scotland, because, yeah, I mean, I would be surprised if other clubs aren't looking closely at the J-League, and, you know, maybe some supporters of some other clubs who do podcasts want to get in touch and want to get the early mail on a couple of players that their club might be in the running for over the summer. So, we'll wait and see. Obviously, Belgium, Germany and Holland seem to be the most well-trodden paths for Japanese players heading to Europe. But now, everybody's eyes have been open to the success that these three players, and, yeah, hopefully Ida Gucci in the future, will have in Scotland. So, yes, you'd imagine, any club doing due diligence would certainly want to be looking at the J-League as well. So, Stuart, I guess as we kind of wrap up this section on Celtic, and yeah, we've still got a chat about how F. Marino's got on in the ACL, and of course this past weekend with the win over Shonan. But I guess specifically on Daizen, then, he was obviously a fan favourite at the Nissan Stadium last season, you know, co-Golden Boot winner with Leandro Damião, headed over to Scotland. And you've obviously been interested in in watching the entire project that Ange has put together this season. I imagine you've been watching Daizen especially closely. So how happy have you been with the way that he's performed?
Yeah, it's been really, really good. And as Jamie's saying, like, you know, from the very start, actually, it was January, wasn't it, when they came in, Hatate and Daizen Idiguchi. They really made a difference from the very start. And what's been really funny is, you know, the reaction of the Scottish fans to Daizen, like the jokes about his running ability is just been hilarious on occasions, because like as in the same way as like Kyogo was chasing after the ball, he's chased all the way around the field and he's at one end and then suddenly he's down the other end, you know, making a trouble for both ends. So it's been really good to watch him, and I think I would say he's playing better than in Marinos, but you know, the goal obviously hasn't got as many goals this year, but it's been really, you know, exciting to watch him, and I've just been so happy watching all of the Japanese players, how they fit in, and just watching them relating to the other players, the non-Japanese players, all of the kind of the press conferences and the promotional stuff has all been very inclusive and really just a pleasure to watch. And whatever team they went to, you know, if they'd had that reaction, it would just have been, you know, a fantastic experience. So, you know, paired with it being Celtic and coming off so well, you know, it's been a real pleasure to watch the whole year.
Yeah, brilliant stuff. So, well, yeah, Jamie, as we wrap this up then, what a special feeling it must have been for you there to be at the stadium on the weekend to see the trophy lifted. Obviously, last season was a very difficult one for all Celtic supporters, but yeah, to bounce back so quickly in Ange's first season has been absolutely terrific. And, well, yeah, to be there at the ground, yeah, just the icing on the cake for you.
Absolutely, mate. Yeah, you're dead on. It was a tough one last season, and I think important to note that we're playing against a very good Rangers side this season, who are competing in the Europa League final in 2 days. So, you know, it's not been the easiest thing to do, to come in and, you know, take over a club that was effectively in tatters, to tell you the truth, a year ago, rebuild the team, you know, get them competing, and then, you know, see them eventually win a league and cup double before the end of the season. Angie's done a sensational job, and as you mentioned, it was excellent being there on Saturday. It was a beautiful day, a real carnival atmosphere, and yeah, I may still have a sore head 2 days later, Bennett. I wouldn't like to confirm that, though, you know.
Yeah, not surprised to hear that at all, mate. All right, so, well, let's move on then. You both obviously dyed in the wool F. Marino supporters. So, yeah, it's obviously a couple of weeks now since the ACL group stage wrapped up over in Southeast Asia. But it was overall a successful trip away, Stuart. Your side finished top of Group H, ahead of South Korean powerhouse Jeonbuk. So overall, a positive group stage, and you look ahead to the knockout stage, and you'll see how far you can get in the tournament. But I guess you've made it one step further than your local rivals, which is one little bit of bragging rights you can have over them for the time being.
Yeah, indeed. But watching this the ACL, like especially, you know, with the timing of some of the late night games and the conditions over there, it wasn't really like a pleasant watching a lot of the matches. I didn't feel that Marinos really played well in any of the matches. You know, they were quite nervy and getting a little bit bullied on the field, much more so than in the J League matches. And well, always, you know, you watch the ACL, and it tends to be quite hard and physical matches, much more than the J League. So looking down at the matches, you know, the first match with the Hagel, as I will call them, they were a lot better than I thought. They were really, I thought, quite a good team, and you know, gave a good run for their money. And we were kind of lucky to beat them in the first match. Leo Sierra being a standing out player there, and then Jeonbuk are always difficult. They're a very good side. Got some good players. So again, we were lucky to get the we weren't lucky, actually. We lost that one, yeah, because Matsubara gave away a penalty kick. So that one, things looked a little bit shaky at that point, so I was a bit nervous. And then the next next match also almost went to the very end with the 1-0 victory against Sydney. Looked a bit flaky again in that one. Lucky not to have conceded goals, but Tsunoda came in at the 81st minute. Now, we mentioned him before. It's his first season, a very young player, came straight out of university. His first match last year, and he's come in and replaced Thiago for quite a lot of matches, him and Eduardo. So he's been looking very strong, and that was his first goal for Marinos. So he really saved the day in that match against Sydney. Next match against Sydney on the 25th, we won 3-0. That was a great match. But again, one of our defenders, Sanatov, scored a fantastic header in the fifth minute. Every time he comes on, it seems that he scores a super goal. You know, we should bring him on as a forward, I think, sometimes. But Nishimura got a goal, some good skill, and then Sonora scored again. So fantastic. But then he got a red card pretty soon after that. So he's really making the headlines. Then back to our Vietnamese team, Hagel. So beat those 2-0, penalty kick from Nakagawa. Foul on Nakagawa. Marcos finished that off. And again, defender Hatanaka scores a goal from a header from a corner. All the defenders scoring. And the last one, Anderson Lopez scored a goal very quickly against John Book. And we let 7 minutes later let one in. So drew out the game to a 1-1. I think we're playing defensively in that game. I think the draw was all we needed. John Book, could have done with a win, but overall we managed to pull through that one. Overall, I really liked Elber playing his play this match. Leo was very good in quite a few matches. Unluckiest player, who even in the J League has been very unlucky almost every match he played, Miyachi, can't get the ball in the net, gets it close, just can't get it in. It's very sad for him, but he's playing well, but doesn't go in. And again, saved by our goalkeeper on many cages, Takaoka. He looked okay, looked very fine. Almost had a fight in the very last minute of the Sydney match as he was bundled into the goal, holding the ball. Yeah, so it was a very scrappy. The whole ACL was very scrappy. The one that won the group, I think we were a little bit lucky. I hope we will be in better form for the knockout round. And I think our first match is against Kobe in August. And I wonder where that will be played. Is that they're going to be played in Japan, maybe?
Yes, we wait and see. All right, so yeah, we wonder what sort of state Kobe will be in by then as well, Jamie. Yeah, so your overall impressions, that maybe a couple of players that stood out, or I guess the players that have impressed you over the course of the season, and yeah, might have enhanced their reputation somewhat in what is a difficult run of games, isn't it? I mean, obviously it's a necessity in these times to get groups of teams over in a bubble like situation to get the games played in as prompt a time as possible, and in as tight a window as possible. So it's challenging for all of the teams that took part. But I guess again, in similar lines to Stuart, you're positive that you've made it through, and you wait and see what happens when you face Kobe in August.
Yeah, I think Stuart's point about it being scrappy was a good one. I'm right in saying there's 115 games played over the space of a few weeks for that group stage, and you can really, you have to commend the organisers for going to the effort to get it going. But I don't think it's any surprise that most of our games are certainly the key goals, and a lot of our games were headers, as Stuart mentioned, because some of the surfaces that the team played on and some of the conditions weren't great. But yeah, overall, glad to get out of it. We that group stage, I should say, and we were left in that weird position where As you mentioned, we don't really know where the next tie is going to be played. And Sean and I were sort of texting back and forth during the last group stage game against John Buck, because even to the last 5 or 10 minutes, we didn't really know if we were going to qualify or not. We were talking about potentially trying to plan to meet the away game, wherever it's located. And it ended up just being, I think both teams had the message communicated to them that a one each draw would be sufficient for qualification. And it just ended up being one of those matches with just two teams sort of passing the ball around the back four and no one really making any effort to progress. And yeah, it wasn't the most enjoyable sort of tournament. I think, you know, in the circumstances, they've done well to get it going, but yeah, wasn't excellent. In terms of individual standout players, I think Stuart mentioned Leo Ciara has been really good and was really good in the group stages in particular. A couple of really, really important goals. So for me, he would probably be the kind of key man. And again, he's in the league, definitely Anderson Lopez has been a most important player in my opinion. But Leo's a kind of underrated forward, I think, kind of big bustling forward who really gets himself in the end of things and can be very powerful on his day. And I think in the group stages, he sort of showed up a bit. So I'm hoping now, and it certainly looks like based on the last two games, I'm hoping now that the players take the momentum from that group stage and you know, a successful group stage and bring that back to the J-League to press on for the remainder of the season.
All right, then. So, yeah, F. Marino's made it through, as did Kobe and Reds, of course. And, yes, F. Marino's will face Kobe in August. And why does Google say Reds' opponent is to be determined, Sam? Are they being handed a ticket through to the last eight, or what's going on there?
I thought it was JT, and I'm not sure why it wouldn't be. So I don't know what Google's found that I don't know about there. But, yeah, I'm sure it's Reds against JDT.
I think, okay, Google's got JDT and TBD a bit confused. So that's a bit of a shame and embarrasses me on the podcast that I didn't know that off the top of my head. But there you go. So, yeah, Reds versus JDT of Malaysia in August as well. That should be a very good game. All right. So, yeah, we'll finish off with our two guests and by chatting about F. Marinos's win on Saturday away at Shonan, a 4-1 victory that, kept the good times rolling. And, now two straight wins in the league since your return to league action, Stuart. And, yes, you were there and, again, recorded a mini Tricolor podcast with Pratik on your way back from the Lemon Gas Stadium. And, just another successful day at the office for F. Marinos. And, the bottom team now, Shonan, after Kobe went above them with their win on the weekend. And, a 4-1 victory. It's Shonan actually had a lot of shots, didn't they, in the game, Stuart? But ultimately, F. Marinos were the team that capitalised on some pretty shoddy defending and scored some excellent goals yourselves.
Yeah. So, yeah, surprisingly, like looking at the stats, actually, yeah, Shonan got 22 shots to Marinos' 14, but both teams had 8 on target. So, yeah, I think it was a little bit dangerous, but Shonan just can't score a goal. That was the overall impression that I came away with. And as we've said before, that you know, they're quite low budget team, but they've got young players and very fast players. They can get the ball right down to the other end, but you know, they're not very good at finishing. So, you know, after our first goal by like a Mizunuma in the 14th minute, then it just looked a little bit more relaxed. And another goal to take us up to halftime by Koiki again, and Anderson Lopez coming in at the 59th minute. Yeah, it was very comfortable. And the final goal in the 90 plus one, that was just had all the potential to be comedy, where Leo managed to get the ball and get it past the goalkeeper who'd come out. And all he had to do was put it in the empty net. And thankfully he did. Otherwise, it would have been definitely on that YouTube compilation of the funniest misses if he'd missed it at that range. So, yeah, it was a very, really nice match. But I noticed today, actually, I was reading one of the Japanese kind of write-ups on the match. And so we had a couple of injuries in that match, and Hatanaka came off, and the Japanese journalist interviewed him because he was okay after the match and said what happened, and he'd got heat stroke. Basically, he'd felt must have felt dizzy because of the heat, and it was quite a hot and humid day. It had been like raining for 24 hours almost. The pitch was quite wet, but not waterlogged in any way. But it was quite hot and bright sunlight that day, and it must have affected him. I was quite surprised to see him going off, and Nakagawa went off after getting a yellow card and. So taking out, I think, was it their defender, Tachi, got a kick from Nakagawa accidentally. But, I felt Marinos was one of those games where we expect to win, we really hope to win, but Shonan always put up a good fight in there, especially in their home stadium.
How pleasing has it been this season, just to see how useful the squad depth has been? As you mentioned, a few injuries there. You've had a lot during the season. Iwata was missing this game. Elbert was missing as well. But you seem to be able to lock in whoever it may be it Fujita in midfield, Sonoda, you mentioned at the back, Nishimura, whoever it might be. It just seems like Muscat has managed to get so many options, and you seem to be, it doesn't matter how many injuries there are, you seem to be able to keep plodding on.
Yes, indeed. I'm always happy looking at the bench. Like, I don't really mind who are the starting members and who are the bench members at the moment. I think any combination can work on a good day. Sometimes we have a bad day, but like you say, yeah, the squad has been good, and none of the players that came in, we were a little bit worried, about the new players, because we didn't know much, obviously didn't know much about them, hadn't seen them play, but all of them have been really, really great, and the young players have been very, very good. I think the only guy we haven't seen is Tala, who came back from Machida. Only saw him in the rainy match against Tosu, but yeah, everybody's been really good, even in the ACL, Kabayama got a little bit of time there. Haven't seen him in the league much this year, but very, very good, and really, I think everybody likes Nishimura so much. Just his personality. Like in the interviews and the way he just so enjoys playing football and scoring goals. I think everybody, kind of started to love him after the first couple of matches. Even Nagato, he's been great. Looks fine. Everybody slotted into the format, and we didn't really know what this year would bring with Kevin taking over fully for this year and bringing in new people, but it's been pretty much same as before. Sometimes a little bit more defensive and a little bit more pragmatic, I think, than Angie's gung ho. We'll score another goal as our defence. Kevin will bring in a defender in the last few minutes to shore things up and make sure that we win. So yeah, it's been very good.
Yeah, it's been really interesting, hasn't it, Jamie? I mean, a team that loses the joint winner of the Golden Boot in the previous season, you don't expect them to be as strong or even stronger in attack and in terms of their goal-scoring numbers the following season, do you? But, yeah, I mean, the way that Anderson Lopez, Sam's favourite, of course, and especially for me, Takuma Nishimura have settled in has been, absolutely tremendous. And, we've spoken about it a number of times on the podcast in the past few weeks. The depth, and as Stuart says there, he doesn't care who starts, because you've got great options to come off the bench. And I mean, it was just spelt out again this weekend. Elber wasn't even in the squad, and Nishimura wasn't needed to come off the bench, and you've still gone ahead and smashed Shonan 4-1. So I mean, I think in attacking areas you can't really have too many complaints. In defense, maybe Eduardo hasn't settled as many of us might have expected him to, but that can come over the summer. So as an overarching question, how are you feeling about how it's gone so far? But more importantly, how positive are you of what's to come for the remainder of the season? Because for the rest of the league, I think it's starting to look very, very ominous, the way that F Marinos are going about things at the moment.
Yeah, I'm very happy with how it's going. And certainly in our season preview podcast, where we discussed the transfer window, Stuart, Tony and I were all quite positive about it. But then the loss of Thiago Martins, you know, and you're wondering, you know, how we're going to replace this guy who has been a rock at the back for the past three, 4 seasons. I think Eduardo's done okay in that time. I think you're right to say that it's been a little bit patchy, but I think he's been okay. And I think maybe this is kind of damning him with faint praise, but I think he's good enough to kind of come in there and do that job. And he's never going to directly replace Thiago Martins, but he's done very well. Where I think, and I think it's what you and Stuart have kind of been touching on here as well, is where I think they've done really well is just the quantity of players that they've brought in who, you know, and as Stuart mentioned, you've got that sort of almost that first team that you can sort of as interchangeable. You know, you've got about 13, 14 players, you know, playing consistently. And for me, that's a bit of a learning, I think, from that 2020 season where, in 2019, you know, managed to win the league and qualify for the Asian Champions League. But then in 2020, obviously, COVID impacted the league and everything was very congested. But I think it was just the sheer volume of games and the time of year that the games were being played at. The players just looked out on their feet towards the end of the summer. And I'm just wondering if this year's qualification for the ACL has meant that the club have taken an approach to say, we're going to go out and we're going to get, you know, 15, 16 guys who can play first team football for us and make sure that the standard and quality doesn't drop off too much when that squad rotation is required. The only thing I would say, though, in my opinion, the one guy who I would not take out of the team at any point is Anderson Lopez and his tiny shots. Because that guy is, you know, we took about the team a few weeks ago against Sanfrecce Hiroshima and lost 2-0. And appreciate there'll be games where he can't play this season. I just think he's so important as a focal point for that front line. Watching Sean Ambilmari in the game at the weekend, in some respects, we kind of put you in mind of Marinos' performances I've seen in the past, where, as Stuart mentioned, you know, you're flying forward and you know, they looked really good on the ball, but there's no one there that's able to finish off. And we've been guilty of that ourselves in the past. And I think when you start Anderson Lopez, you're going to put himself, he's going to put himself in the positions to score goals. But with regards to that weekend there, you know, four goals, four different goal scorers. You know, delighted with that performance, and hopefully, as you mentioned, it is ominous for the rest of the league, because I do think we're in with a chance this season of certainly competing for the championship. In which case, I'll need to make another trip back over later this year, hopefully, if the rules allow me.
Yeah, fair enough. And of course, it's worth remembering that this F Marinos attack used to include Ado Onaiwu as well, and he's been he's left and again just been seamlessly replaced, it seems, by the next player, the next cab off the rank. The F Marinos machine is clicking along very nicely at the moment. All right then, guys. Well, it was absolutely terrific to catch up with you both, and sharing some of your joy over Celtic's triumph. Jamie, I'm sure you're on the waters again for the next few days after what's been a huge few days. Again, congratulations. Thanks for joining us. And, we're looking forward to hearing the next instalment of the Tricolour Pridecast. And, hopefully you can continue that throughout the season. So, thanks for joining us, mate. It's been terrific.
Absolute pleasure, man. Thanks for all the work you've done with us over the years. It's always good fun to listen to Ben and Sam. Nice to meet you too, mate.
Terrific. Thanks, Jamie. And Stuart, great to catch up with you again. And continued success for F Marinos. And same with Jamie. Look forward to hearing from you on the Tricolour Pridecast soon.
Yeah, we're enjoying putting them out. And if we can get all the schedule together, we've got... three different continents linking up, and then we got our walking back to the station catch-ups after most matches. So enjoying our Marinos football this year.
Okay, welcome back to part two. Yes, terrific to catch up with Stuart and Jamie there in part one. When we briefly discussed at the end there, F Marinos staying third in the table with their 4-1 away win over Shonan. So above them and still top of the pile after match day 13 is Kashima Antlers. We wondered how this game might pan out, Sam, after Antlers' defeat last time out, and Sapporo on this uncharacteristic, easy for me to say, run of clean sheets. But that was, torn up in just the 6th minute by ISA Wader. And from there, it was very much a procession in the first hour for a very powerful looking Antlers team.
Yeah, you stole the exact words I had written down there. It was a procession because, yeah, once the floodgates open in that Sapporo defence, it seems that they just come pouring in, because the last game they lost was that 5-0 against Tosu, and it looked for a long period like this was going to go exactly the same way, because that first half, yeah, Kashima were fantastic. Pituka was back in midfield and starting, and it was his through ball that set Wader away, and he was playing those throughout that game. And the back line of Sapporo was completely open, and it was so easy for the clever movement of Wader and Kaike and Suzuki just to pick them apart, and that's what they were doing in that first half. I thought they were terrific, and yeah, it's a really good response considering just how poor they were last week.
Well, yeah, you got a number of calls right on last week's episode, Sam. Most notably, our picks of the weekend. Mine didn't come in at all, but this was one of yours, and it was a very good call. And, well, you also mentioned that after that defeat last week, that Antlers would be well advised to get Diego Pachuca back into the starting 11. And as you say, he set up the first goal for ISA Wader in just the 6th minute. And then his another terrific through ball from him sent Arthur Kaike away in the 25th minute. And Antlers were awarded a penalty after Kaike was taken out by Takanori Sugino on the edge of the box. We were discussing in the green room that we weren't going to play the VAR drop until much later on in the episode. But VAR noticing that Sugino was off his line by a stride as he saved Yuma Suzuki's spot kick, the resultant penalty after that Sugino foul. I don't know. That's one of those Tiki Touchwood things that you just, I just don't like to see. And I mean, the VAR deciding that, yeah, it needed to be retaken, and actually Sugino properly taking the piss by jumping 2 metres outside of his goal as Suzuki took the second kick and actually scored. But for me, yeah, not drop worthy, but that's a little bit fidgety from VAR, and I'm not a fan.
Yeah, I didn't like it either. It was millimetres off. I mean, it's so just petty just to go and look at it. I don't think he gained a major advantage by being that far off, but technically, by the letter of the law, they've made the correct decision. But yeah, I didn't like it at all. I mean, when I was watching it, because I watched so many games at the same time, I don't think I had the sound on this game, so I wasn't sure whether they were giving it for him being off his line or if there was some encroachment as well, because there were players in the area. But either decision I thought would have been harsh, and yeah, I can understand the frustration that Sapporo would have felt there, especially as Suzuki slotted away the second one with ease.
Yeah, most definitely. So that was a 2-0 Antlers in the 30th minute, and it was 3-0 by the break as Ryuji Izumi's lovely ball down the right in behind the defence released Kaike, who squared across the box and found Suzuki, who's a sweet first-time finish, put the game to bed in first-half stoppage time. And, well, if there was any, even the faintest hope of a Sapporo revival, it was quashed in just the 3rd minute of the second half when Yuta Higuchi swung in a free kick from deep on the right, and Kaike Rose to head in from just inside the penalty spot. So, yeah, a thoroughly impressive attacking performance from Antlers, and well and truly bouncing back from last week's stunning defeat to Hiroshima. There was a consolation for Consadole as Daiki Suga continued his recent purple patch with a rasper in off the underside of the bar from 20 yards in the 69th minute. So, yes, after that run of alternating wins and draws for the last 5 games, Sam, I guess, yeah, the game was well and truly up for Sapporo this past weekend. But, a real indication here and Antlers putting down a marker that shows the rest of the league what they're capable of.
Yeah, absolutely. They've got themselves into a position now. I think it's we've got a fairly clear top three. I don't know if you argue with that, but I think the three that are currently top three will probably be there at the end. And yeah, Antlers have made the most so far this season of the lighter schedule compared to the other teams. And this was just a showcase of what they can be at their best. I think it was almost their best team. You'd probably want to fit Ryotaro Araki in there, but yeah, I just thought the way that front six with those two midfielders, Pitukura and Higuchi, are both fantastic, and then the four of them, the way that they combine, the way that they switch positions, it was so difficult for Sapporo to deal with. And yeah, there was a defence that had come into the game, we should be full of confidence from the way that they defended, but yeah, they were just torn apart. And yeah, it's just a sign that when things click, Antlers can be very dangerous, and you imagine they're only going to get better as the season goes on and they get more used to Rene Weiler's way of playing.
That's it. I think there's a lot of room for improvement still for Antlers and for F Marinos, but I wonder whether we can say the same thing really about Kawasaki, and that's perhaps a strange thing to say after all of the success they've had in the last five seasons. But as we've outlined, as more and more players just seem to be lured away from the club, sooner or later there had to become a breaking point when the depth of their squad would be sorely tested and perhaps even brutally exposed. And that hasn't come yet, but maybe over the over the long hot summer we might find that the attacking riches that we spoke about with Jamie and Stuart in part one, and we've been speaking about pretty much all season, as they've had to cope with so many injuries and personnel disruptions. And Antlers, obviously, with Yuma Suzuki, one of the biggest fish in Japanese football, coming back to the club, only strengthening them up front. But it does bode well for both of those clubs, and it does properly throw down a marker to Frontale, and it's going to be one of the fascinating subplots of the season to see how they go about defending their crown again with two serious challenges right up the sharp end of the table. And I concur. I can't see anybody else getting close to those top three, especially because the other two I think we expected to challenge are currently down in the bottom three in Urawa and Kobe, of course. They haven't quite broken away yet, but yes, the signs are ominous, most heavily for the rest of the league. And next we'll cover the last of the top three teams. Then Kawasaki stayed in second and 2 points behind Antlers with what I guess, Sam, was ultimately a regulation 2-0 home victory over Fukuoka. They haven't always hit their stride in games this season, have they, Frontale? And it did take them a while here as well, but as we've seen them do so many times over the course of the last five seasons, a 1-2 punch did for Fukuoka, and in this case it was goals from Daiya Tono and Shintaro Kurumaya just before the hour that saw Frontale ultimately cruise to victory.
Yeah, it was kind of one of those performances from Frontale where, just that moment, like 5 minutes of a game, that's all they really needed to do in this one to win it, because it was, they were struggling to break down Avispa for the first half. Avispa are very well organised back there. It is difficult to get through, but eventually they just about found a way. And then, they have that ability and that knack of scoring a second goal quickly after the first and putting a game to bed. And that's what they did here. It's... I thought they took their goals well. Daiya Tono has had to come in. We mentioned how Marinos have been able to rotate their side. Frontale don't seem to have as many options at that, and they're without Oshima, obviously, and Chanatip at the moment. So Tono has had to come in, but he just seems to... It's taken him a little while, really, to get up to the level of previous players behind him, and I don't think he's quite anywhere near really Hatate's level or Tanaka's, but he is gradually improving, and I thought his first time finish here was very nice. And Frontale did just about enough to win. Once they got 2-0 up, they were good enough to keep Avispa at arm's length for the majority of the game, although Jung had to make one incredible save to deny Tatsuki Nara.
Yeah, that would have been a special homecoming for Nara, obviously, wouldn't it? And I don't think Neil Debnam would have minded if, Frontale had have lost their clean sheet if it was Nara doing the scoring. But, yeah, a terrific save from Jung in the 67th minute to keep out Nara's point-blank header. Indeed, he pushed it onto the bar, and the Frontale defence were able to clear. So, Fukuoka... They're still in mid-table. This is a game where they would have been fairly happy with the way they'd acquitted themselves, especially in the first half, and then I suppose into the first 10 minutes or so of the second. But they were caught out a little, and their offside trap was in pieces when Miki Yamane passed to Tono, who did finish especially well first time. But it's just one of those for Fukuoka, I suppose. If they had have gotten anything out of the game away at the defending champions, then, you know, it would have been a bonus. But, they've got obviously other fish to fry in terms of teams around them in the table that they'll be looking to take points off.
Oh, yeah, definitely. But they will look at this game and the way that they conceded the two goals, because if you can keep Kawasaki at bay in general play, then you expect to deal with the set pieces. But it was two set pieces that they kind of... took their eye off the ball a little bit. This was a quick throw-in for the first goal. They didn't quite set themselves and obviously left themselves open. It was a good pass from Yamane and a good finish. But, yeah, they'd expect to be tighter in that area. And the second goal is a corner, and Tatsuki Nara just doesn't get off the ground, meeting Kurumaya, who is buoyant after his ACL goal-scoring exploits. And he's carried that on into the league. But, yeah, Vispa, they'd be very frustrated to have conceded in the manner that they have, having limited Kawasaki in general play.
Indeed. All right, so it's as you were at the top of the table then, with Kashima, Kawasaki and Yokohama F. Marinos all enjoying convincing victories in match day 13. And next to the game that I guess some people might have expected we might have led the episode with, Sam, if it weren't for our two guests, of course, and that is the amazing fact that Vissel Kobe have finally won a J1 game in 2022 at the 12th time of asking, and they did it in some style. They don't do things by halves at Vissel, do they? It was Andres Iniesta getting them on their way in just the second minute. Koya Uruki made it 2-0 in the 14th, and then Yoshinori Muto and Yuya Osako added the gloss in the second half. But I guess what a way to break your duck. And any nerves in the stands at the Neue Vira Stadium were settled thanks to Iniesta's goal in just the second minute.
Yeah, well, that was absolutely crucial, because the longer it goes with Kobe having not won in the league, they'd get nervous. The players would get nervous, and it would allow Tosu into the game. But yeah, they started off so well. I mean, so often last season we would talk about that trio that they had of Furuhashi, Iniesta and Sakai working down that left-hand side. And it looks in this game they went towards that similar way of playing, but with Muto in place of Furuhashi, and it worked really well. I mean, the combination from Sakai and Iniesta led to a number of the goals, at least the first the first three actually were involving those sorts of players. And yeah, it was just a really positive performance. I thought at the back they looked more settled without Kikuchi. I just think maybe he needs a bit of time away, and maybe the suspension was a blessing in disguise for this game. And even in midfield, Osaki sat in with Yamaguchi, and it looked more solid. Ogihara just hasn't yet got to grips with things in midfield, so his absence probably helped. And the big call they made was dropping Osako to the bench, and I think again that helped Kobe in the way they were playing, because with Iniesta in that hole, I think Muto is the player best to operate off him, because he will run down the channels and Iniesta will find him, whereas Osako would probably drop into the same space that Iniesta would want to play in, and it wouldn't really work, I don't think. Like, Osako works for Japan in that there's no number 10, so he drops in to fill that void, but yeah, it wouldn't work as well, I don't think, with Iniesta. So yeah, Muto, I thought, played really well. I thought, he dragged the Tosu defenders all over the place, and Iniesta is obviously going to find him more often than not. So yeah, I thought the setup really worked for them, and it was a really positive result. I just wonder, where has it been for the rest of the season?
Well, that is the million dollar question, isn't it? And That early goal got them up and running, and from there I guess you could see the confidence bursting out of them. And yeah, Muto did especially well. He did need to win the ball back for the second goal with Iniesta playing in Yuruki, and then a terrific volley from Muto with his tail up just past the hour to make it 3. So for Tosu, after the win last week away at FC Tokyo, they would have been hoping to build on that and continue their terrific start to the season. It wasn't to be for them, but I guess for now, we can just celebrate in the fact that Vissel Kobe have remembered how to win a game. And they'll have a very, very stern test, though, on Wednesday night when they play their game in hand. They host Kawasaki, so it'll be interesting to see how the atmosphere is at the Noriveru Stadium for that one before they travel to Shonan for a battle of the bottom on Saturday, the second battle of the bottom that Belmari will be hosting this season. Of course, the first one hosting Hiroshima didn't go particularly well for Shonan. They'll be hoping to turn things around against Kobe on Saturday. All right then. So it was also a good weekend for Kobe's fellow Kansai club Gamba Osaka. But unlike Vissel, who scored early and ultimately cruised to victory, Gamba certainly did not have things all their own way, Sam, when they travelled to Kashiwa Racehole in the late night kickoff on Saturday. Indeed, from the highlights, the chances were almost all Racehole's, apart from a Hiroto Yamami chip where he tried to catch out Kim Sung-gyu, who had advanced out of his box just for a change, but Yamami missed the target. But ultimately, it was a Dawan shot past Kim in the 71st minute that won it for a Gamba Osaka side. Is it fair to call this a smash and grab, or is that a bit harsh on the visitors?
Well, it probably was a smash and grab, but you've got to give it to them, I suppose, because Gamba came into the game. Obviously, they'd already got their injury crisis with Sami Kurata, etc. They came in with 7 players out with COVID as well, so they could barely form a team. They're having youngsters come in on the bench. Harumi Minamino was one of them. Rikuto Kuwahara was called in as well from the youth team. So, yeah, they just about managed to form a squad. So for them to have competed in this game, I think you've got to give them a lot of credit for that. And, yeah, Kashiwa were the better side. And, Mateus Savio hit the post. Osoya had good chances. Ichimori, I thought, played very well in the Gamba goal, but Gamba managed to hold on. They kept themselves in the game and took their chance when it came. So yeah, I'm going to give a lot of credit to Gamba for the way they managed to battle in this one, but Kashiwa will see this as 3 points dropped, absolutely.
Yeah, it's been a very up and down last few weeks, hasn't it, for Racehole? But as you say there, for Gamba, with their squad stretched to the absolute limit, it's a massive credit to Mr. Katon Osaka that he was able to get a squad that organized, and to ultimately come away with a victory away from home is terrific credit to him, his staff, and the players that were able to take the field in a Gamba kit. And Dawan has become especially important to them, hasn't he, Sam, since he's established himself in the team. It's good to see, because I think there were maybe a few of us who were doubting how much of an impact that he might have, but he's now that he's appears to be well settled, he's definitely doing the business for them.
Well, there's always kind of a roll of the dice, isn't there, when you bring in a foreign player from Brazil, especially when you have to deal with the COVID issues at the start, so he couldn't enter the country for a long while, and then it takes some players a long time to get build up their fitness if they haven't really been training properly beforehand. But it looks like Dawan was really well drilled himself, and he got himself in really good shape. So as soon as he arrived, he was straight into the team pretty much. He played in a League Cup game off the bench and then has started every league game since. And he's been vital in that midfield. He ostensibly plays the holding role, but I mean, he's turned up with a few crucial goals already this season. And that partnership that he has with Mitsuki Saito when Saito plays as well, I think that's a really nice balance that they've got in midfield. So yeah, a really good pickup this one from Gamba, and he's been exemplary in everything that he's done so far.
Yeah, that's terrific. And just out of interest, how did Harumi Minamino look when he came on in the 74th minute? I remember Johnny saying he's not a relation of Takumi, but obviously the name piques some interest for me, and I'm sure for a number of other listeners as well. So, yeah, it's a big stage to be thrown in on. But, yeah, how did he look?
Yeah, bright. I mean, don't think he played. He got too much of the action. I think he was, because it was mainly Raysol attacking at that stage, so they were already pretty much defending a lead for the most of it. But yeah, he made some fairly intelligent runs and just didn't quite get on the ball enough for me to give like a real look at, you know, this is how great he was with his movement, or it was a great dribble or whatnot. But he looked enthusiastic. He looked decent enough from what I saw, but it was only a small outing. So I'm hoping that in the Levain Cup in a couple of days, he might get a start in that one. So we'll have a better look at what he might be able to bring to the table.
Fair enough then. All right. And well, yeah, we should mention there was almost a sensational end to this game in the 96th minute when Raysol defender Taiyo Koga pumped a long ball forward and Hiromu Mitsumaru timed his run to perfection, but his back header came back off the post and then got stuck in his feet from the rebound, and Ichimori claimed, leaving Gumba to celebrate. Yes, the second straight league win that took them up to 10th in the table, but it was almost a most dramatic of endings, and Raysol almost claimed what might have been a deserved equaliser on the day. But again, as Sam said, yeah, Gumba deserve all the plaudits for coming away with the 3 points, as frustrating as it was for Kashiwa to take. All right, so to the next game, and we'll head to the Toyota Stadium, where it wasn't a clean sweep for the Kansai teams on the weekend, because the Cerezo Osaka tasted defeat away at Nagoya Grampus by a scoreline of the same as the previous game, 1-0. And, similar to Kobe, Nagoya made a dream start when their main attacking man, Mateus, sent a Keiya Sento racing clean through in just the 6th minute. Sento had all the time in the world to pick his spot, Sam. If he had his time back, he wouldn't have shot that close to Kim Jin-hyun, would he? But I guess an uncharacteristically feeble attempt to save by Kim. Maybe he was expecting he'd have to stretch out a bit more, but that's one that Kim would love to have back. It basically went straight through him.
It was a really poor piece of goalkeeping, to be fair. It was great that he was back and able to play after the incident the previous week, where, yeah, he wants his time again here. I mean, it was a poor effort, really, from Sento straight at the goalkeeper. He won him right into the bottom corner. But, yeah, maybe Kim was expecting him to put it in the bottom corner and didn't expect it to be right at him, because he really kind of fluffed the attempt. It was really, in general, it was poor play from Cereza, because it was Suzuki in midfield who just dives into a tackle quite recklessly, and Mateus just watches him go past and skirts away from him before playing the ball through to Sento, and the defence was caught flat-footed. So, yeah, all in all, a really poor passage of play for Cereza Osaka. But, yeah, Nagoya deserved their lead, and they were the team that were the ones that were more aggressive at maybe in the first half an hour or so. It did kind of settle a little bit, and Cereza got into it. But yeah, the rest of the game, I suppose, was Mateus's frustration with his teammates for not being able to stay onside.
Well, that's it. Yeah, VAR just didn't want Mateus to score a goal on Saturday, did it? He had the ball in the net twice, the first in the 33rd minute, but the narrowest of offsides against Noriyoshi Sakai in the build-up. And I mean, we've spoken about it before, Sam, if they're going to get their lines out, then they've got to at least give the benefit of the doubt to the attacker. And that wasn't the case here. For me, Sakai was, level at worst. I guess somebody in the VAR room spotted a fingernail or something offside, and that was it for that goal. Mateus's first ball in the net of the afternoon. And then in the 65th minute, a lazy piece of play from Ishida, the sub. He's looking at the halfway line, but he strides over it before the ball is played out of the Nagoya half by his teammate. And then the ball is ultimately worked into the center, where it deflects off Mata Jonic, and an instinctive header in from Mateus, which was a terrific goal, but again, it didn't count. In the meantime, shortly after the restart, Adam Taggart had a golden opportunity to make it 1-1, Sam, but a fingertip from Mitch Langerak getting to a ball across the box from John Patrick was just enough to take it out of Taggart's stride. Otherwise, he would have had a tap-in from 6 yards. But apart from that, yes, Cerezo's chances were of more of the speculative kind, and it just wasn't their day. And the Nagoya clean sheet machine, I don't know, is it slowly creaking back into action again?
Well, at least they found it, I suppose, and they're working on it. It was a lot better defensively in this game. I'm glad you mentioned Langerak's touch on that ball across to Taggart, because that made its way to various clip Twitter accounts about how poor a miss it was from Taggart. But yeah, it's a crucial piece of goalkeeping to flick it away from him. And yeah, otherwise, Cerezo, as you say, were restricted to long-range efforts. Maikuma had probably the best of those going just wide, but generally, yeah, they were kept at arm's length, and that is what Nagoya used to be able to do, and maybe that will be what they can do for the rest of this season. But yeah, it was an improvement for sure for Nagoya, and an interesting decision Cerezo have to make now, as Takashi Inui's ban, well, self-imposed ban, I suppose, is up. So will they be bringing him back into it just to give a little bit more quality in those forward areas? I think that'll be an interesting one to look at next weekend.
Yeah, most definitely. So whether he's been able to bury the hatchet with Akio Kogiku in the meantime, and whether Kogiku is, I don't know how that will make him look to the rest of the squad if he just throws Inui straight back in. I can't see it personally, but you'd have to think he'd be on the bench at best in his first game back. But that is an interesting one to watch for this coming weekend, and indeed for, I guess, the next month or so, as to how Inui is worked back into the setup, if at all, of course, provided the manager and the player have been able to smoke the peace pipe, as it were. We'll wait and see. For Nagoya, goes without saying, a much needed victory, just their third of the season. It still sees them down in the bottom six, but now just 3 points behind Cerezo, who are eighth, as there is quite a logjam developing in mid-table, with, as we mentioned earlier, the top three threatening to break away, and then Kashiwa the best of the rest in fourth, and only 6 points separates them down to Jubilo Iwata in 14th. And, well, speaking of a third victory of the season, Iwata got theirs as well, 2-1 at home over FC Tokyo on Saturday afternoon. I don't want to take anything away from Iwata here, Sam, because they were pegged back and they've ultimately won it with a terrific goal from Naoki Kanuma in his first J1 start, 2 minutes from time. But, I know we've made a lot of excuses for Tokyo with their defensive injuries and this, that, and the other, but maybe I should just get this out of the way first before we do properly give Iwata their credit. But that's just one win in 7 games now for FC Tokyo. And you can make all the excuses you like about injuries, etc., but there's other clubs going through, COVID outbreaks, let alone having two defenders out, and two central defenders seem to have just destroyed the whole thing at FC Tokyo in the past few weeks. And all I'll say is that FC Tokyo's last 3 defeats have come against Fukuoka, Tosu, and Iwata, and that is simply not good enough. I mean, we can joke around all we like about J-Talk derbies, etc., but Fukuoka should not be a rival of FC Tokyo. FC Tokyo should be challenging for the league, challenging for the top 3 or 4 every single season. But again, there's all these caveats and excuses, but 7th after 13 games, I think it's a false position, to be perfectly honest. And there were obviously cause for optimism after a couple of good performances, a couple of different performances that we'd seen under Kenta Hasegawa for the last few seasons. But since then, it's just, seems to be sliding backwards. And again, I don't want to take anything away from Iwata, because they kept going and, they deserve to win. So, I think I can draw a line under that rant, Sam, and we can go ahead and we can give some praise to Iwata for, as I said, their third victory of this season, and it was well deserved.
You're trying to get your own segment to rival Robson's rant, so we can try it, I suppose. But yeah, well said, everything there. I just thought, obviously, the defending was a slight issue. But going forward, even when you've got Leandro, you've got Diego, you've got Nagai playing, I just thought nothing came off in this game. Everyone just couldn't pass to each other. Every attack was breaking down. So yeah, I just thought it was very frustrating for me watching, let alone FC Tokyo supporters. But yeah, the credit has to go to Iwata. They've done it a number of times this season where it looks like the game's probably going away from them, or they're not going to get anything out of it or whatnot, but they keep going until the end. They have this desire within the squad, and yeah, the amount of points they've picked up late in games is credit to them, and credit to the manager. Yeah, it was a lovely finish from Kanuma. I think Shuto Abe would like his time back again, because the clearance was dreadful. Then he got the ball caught under his feet, but then when it does come out to Kanuma, puts it into that far corner, and there was no chance for Slovic. And yeah, the two goals that Jubilo scored, because the Uehara one, it's right at the start, well, just before half time, at the pullback from Suzuki, Uehara hits it first time again into the bottom corner. It was a lovely goal from Jubilo. So yeah, full credit to them. They're keeping their heads above water. They will be nervously looking behind and seeing Urawa there, and then Kobe have just got a big victory. So yeah, it's not plain sailing yet for Jubilo. But yeah, the way that they set up, the way that they keep fighting, is a real credit to them.
Yeah, most heavily. I mean, that first goal was the dictionary definition of a training ground drill, wasn't it? I mean, They passed it out from their own box. Ricardo Grassa passed it out to Yasuhito Endo, who had nobody around him. Endo played it out to Rikio Uehara, who had nobody around him. Uehara dribbled forward 30 yards. Nobody went near him. He played it out to Yuto Suzuki on the right, who was in acres of space. Suzuki could have done anything, but he decided to play it back across the box to Uehara, who was, you guessed it, completely unmarked. And, I mean, it's a good finish, but literally, I mean, they walked the ball from back to front. There was nobody at all in the Tokyo midfield or, indeed, in the defence looking to, to make a challenge or close anybody down. So it's a good goal. It is literally straight off the training ground. It's what, you know, teams do when they're warming up for a training session, just passing the ball back and forth to each other. It looked like Tokyo were going to make the most of a reprieve that they'd gotten when Fabian Gonzalez rounded Jakub Slovic on the hour, but then fired into the side netting. That was when Adailton curled in a brilliant equaliser in the 79th minute. You might remember Adailton, a former favourite of the punters of the Yamaha Stadium terraces, but he declined to celebrate against his former club. And Tokyo could have gone ahead, but Diego Oliveira shot too close to Ryuki Miura shortly after they had equalized. But then Kanuma's terrific first time finish won it for Iwata, and as Sam said, continued their happy knack of scoring late, either equalizing or winning games. And they've done it again at home over Tokyo on Saturday afternoon. And that leaves us with two games left to review, listeners. They were my two picks to watch on last week's episode, and wouldn't you know it, my luck was out over the weekend, most definitely, as both of my picks ended 0-0. I mean, you know, it wasn't Robinson Crusoe suggesting you watch Urawa versus Hiroshima on Friday night. It did shape as one of the most entertaining games of the round. And indeed, Sam, it wasn't a damp squib at all, was it? Even though the conditions were very wet and wild at Saitama Stadium on Friday night.
No, it did get going, especially in the second half, where goalkeepers were definitely on top, with Osaka especially made several very good saves as Urawa looked to create chances. They brought Junker on, Moberg had chances, Osaka had a good effort, but Osaka was just up to everything that was thrown at him. And at the other end, Nishikawa likewise made a couple of very good saves. So just neither team managed to find that clear clinical edge, I suppose, at the end. And we might have to bring out the jingle as well, because we've got an interesting moment where Reds thought they'd scored early on, and that could have completely altered the game and been we might have then got the goal fest that we were probably hoping for.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there was plenty of goal mouth action in the second half. But yes, one of our patrons, Chris, wants an answer. So yeah, we better play the drop.
This week in VAR.
Okay, so we'll just set the scene. Yeah, in the 14th minute, Reds defender Kazuaki Maratari sent in a 30-yard free kick from, well, deep on the left, slightly central area, but, yeah, not out by the touchline. But, yeah, a good 35, 40 yards from goal. He sailed it into the box, and it bounced in, bounced through the box and in off Keisuke Osako's left-hand post. The Reds players obviously celebrated. Mawatari couldn't believe his luck. But then the, yes, the what transpired over the next few minutes left us all, and Chris especially, scratching his head. Chris wonders why and how that disallowed goal was offside, please. And, well, yeah, while you're at it, I would like a detailed explanation myself as well, Sam.
Well, I'm not sure I'm going to be able to provide it, to be honest. Well, first of all, Iwanami is in an offside position, so that's the first thing cleared up. And he's going towards the ball, but he doesn't get anywhere near it. He definitely doesn't touch it, and it sails through, goes in. And I think it's very harsh to give it as offside. What Alex Bishop popped up and suggested may have been the cause, that the goalkeeper makes a move as if to react to Iwanami and to the way he might have headed the ball, and that is then puts him off and is classed as an interference. And I can understand that argument, and it may well be that they have given it for that, but I don't think he... I try to check the laws of the game and see if I could understand it, and he doesn't touch it, he doesn't go near the ball, and he doesn't obstruct anybody else from getting the ball, because the Hiroshima defender has got no chance of clearing it, and he's not in the line of vision of Osako at all. So I think this is a really harsh one to rule out, but I caveat that with I'm not 100% clear on the minutiae of the law, so maybe if Alan Gibson is listening, he could let us know, or if the J-League judge replay could clear that one up, because I think it's harsh whichever way, and maybe to the letter of the law it is a correct decision, but it definitely seems a tough decision to me.
Yeah, I mean, I guess for me, the issue is the distance that Iwanami is from the ball and from the goal, and the fact that he is offside. There's no question about that. And he does, you know, for a period of time, run in the direction of the ball. But then as it approaches him, you can clearly see him pull out of making an attempt to try and get it. So, again, maybe it is the fact that, yes, there's a half movement from Osako as a reaction to Iwanami. And again, we're left scratching our heads because, you know, it's not detailed how exactly the decision is made. You can kind of see how it's how they've come to that conclusion. But again, I mean, it's obviously a completely different situation to the retake and penalty in the Sapporo Kashima game. But it's one of those where, you know, I don't literally think Osako was impacted by Iwanami's presence. So for me, yeah, that is a very difficult one for Reds to have to put up with. I mean, the one last week away at Kashima was technically offside, so that one wasn't unlucky. That was just unfortunate, I suppose, that Alex Schultz wasn't able to hold his run. But in this, Alex Schalk, sorry, wasn't able to hold his run. But on this occasion, yeah, it just appears that, VAR has dealt a very dirty hand to Reds. Again, 0-0, I guess it doesn't really do this game justice, not just that disallowed goal for Reds, but yeah, the number of chances. But again, terrific goalkeeping, as you said, Sam, from Osako in the Hiroshima goal. And Shusaku Nishikawa for Reds saw this game end scoreless. And yeah, that's now five straight draws for Reds as, Iwata's win. They're 2 points ahead of Reds now, but Reds are in the bottom three, with just Kobe and Shonan below them after they've played 12 games. And, of course, the rest of the league, apart from the ACL clubs, have played 13. And, okay, then, well, yeah, properly swallowing my my pride here. I was bigging up Kyoto Shimizu on last week's podcast, and that also ended 0-0. Again, terrific goalkeeping on display. Naoto Kamifukimoto for the hosts, Kyoto, and Shuichi Gonda for Shimizu. Sam, both teams had good chances over the course of the 90 minutes, though Sanga sub Fuki Yamada will be having nightmares about his chance in second half stoppage time that Gonda saved. And not quite in the same vein, but Espol sub Yuta Kamiya went close with a long range effort at the end of the game as well, but was denied by a sprawling Kami Fukumoto. So another frantic finish, but ultimately neither side able to make the breakthrough here too.
Yeah, I thought this was quite a decent open game, but I'm just looking through my notes here, and I think I probably just cut and paste the word shoot straight at the goalkeeper, because that seems to what I've put for most of these chances. I thought the goalkeepers played well, but yeah, some of the finishing was not quite as clinical as it should be. They didn't find the corners. They were just, yeah, it was on target, but that was as good as you could say about it. I think, yeah, when the Utaka has just gone through a little bit of a phase in the last couple of games where it's not quite working out for him. He's not quite getting the goals that he perhaps was definitely in previously in the season. But so far for Kyoto, nobody else has stood up. And you mentioned Yamada there, a glorious opportunity right at the end. But yeah, just didn't show the composure to beat Gonda. So yeah, Kyoto still going through a little bit of a tough period at the moment. Just need to find a spark from somewhere other than Utaka if it's not quite Utaka's day. And Shimizu, yeah, I'm still waiting for them to click into gear, and it might be a hill I die on this season, saying that Shimizu will improve and will get better. This was the first game that Carlinhos started, and he had one reasonable effort saved early in the first half, but again, they didn't really create a clear cut chance, or didn't make the most of the chances that did come their way. So yeah, I think both teams on the face of it will probably accept the point. But yeah, it was just, yeah, maybe a little lack of quality on both ends in forward areas.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, Utaka still top of the pile when it comes to the Golden Boot. But yeah, he was joined on 8 goals by Ayase Wada over this weekend, with Yuma Suzuki and Anderson Lopez lurking behind on 6. So yeah, that's going to be another fascinating race to watch over the course of the season. Though, yes, Utaka very much the one-man band at Kyoto, while obviously Wada and Suzuki both banging them in for Antlers. And Lopez currently the leading scorer at F Marinos, but as we've detailed, a number of excellent attacking options at Kevin Muscat's disposal, no question. So all right, that's all 9 games from J1 Matchday 13 rounded up then. And all that's left to do, listeners, is to fill you in on what's coming up in the next week or so in Japanese football, indeed in the top flight. So we've already mentioned that Kobe host Kawasaki on Wednesday, as do Urawa. They welcome Yokohama F Marinos to the Saitama Stadium as the 4 ACL teams play their games in hand. So after Wednesday night, yes, everybody will have played 13 games. And if Frontale are able to win away at Kobe, obviously that will see them return to the top of the table. And Reds, as we said just previously, coming off the 5 straight draws, and they need something to kickstart their season, as we said, down in the bottom 3, while F Marinos come in obviously on a rich vein of form with the 3 straight wins. So yeah, they should be 2 really interesting games on Wednesday night. And then Sam, I'm just going to completely cede the floor to you when it comes to the weekend. Obviously my picks were horrendous last week, so it's called Sam's Pick of the Weekend for a reason. So all I'll say is that there's a couple of interesting looking derbies on the slate. I don't know whether you're going to pick them or not, but Cerezo host Gumba in the battle for Osaka bragging rights at 2:00 on Saturday, and the purple derby between Hiroshima and Kyoto begins Saturday's action at 1:00. But I don't know how far you've cast your eyes when it comes to the weekend's game. So what indeed is Sam's Pick of the Weekend?
Well, I don't like this pressure, actually. I quite like you joining me because I usually pick terribly. And you bailed me out last week. But yeah, I'm going to go for Tokyo versus Kashiwa. I think that is a very interesting game. I just wanted to say Tokyo have to find a way of playing and they need to sort themselves out, quite frankly. And Ray Sol are just in that little bit of dodgy form where it's kind of, they perform okay one week, a bit poor the next. It's two teams that need to just kind of rediscover themselves a little bit. And I think it's a vital game for Tokyo at home. I think it's a winnable game, but yeah, it's just, can you find that way of playing, that click between those front three? I think when you saw Cornell and Dalton combined towards the end of that game, maybe those two have done enough to get into the starting lineup. But yeah, that's kind of an interesting game. I'm not going to say it's going to be a high scoring affair necessarily, but that has my intrigue. And then, yeah, you can't look beyond, I don't think, the Osaka derby. When that's on the slate, it's always a big game. Both teams in that ruckus of mid-table teams split. How many points is between them? What? No points, actually. They're both level on points. And, yeah, it's arguably at that point of the season where those mid-table teams can decide, are we going to be a team that's going to challenge for maybe that fourth place and potentially the ACL, or are you going to be in that relegation battle? And you could make an argument for either way for both of these teams. So, yeah, I think this comes at a really interesting part of the season. So, yeah, that's going to be a really interesting game. And, yeah, if you were to pick one, Ben, what would you be going for?
Well, yeah, I definitely wouldn't have picked Tokyo Kashiwa because I'll be watching. I have to watch that, but I'll be watching through my fingers. Yeah, I don't want to jinx both of these teams for the second straight week, but I think Hiroshima Kyoto has, a lot going for it. Again, we're waiting and hoping that Kyoto will kick back into a bit of form and that they can spread the goals around, while Hiroshima have obviously looked terrific in the past few weeks. So apologies to fans of those two teams if I've jinxed them to a 0-0 again, but we'll wait and see. Of course, the battle of the bottom always fascinates me, so we'll see how Shonan and Kobe get on. Depending how Kobe have gotten on against Kawasaki in midweek, a win there for Kobe, they might be leaving Shonan in their dust. So there's a lot riding on pretty much every game for Shonan, because they're at serious risk of getting cut adrift if Kobe can click into any sort of form at all. All right, then. So we will leave it there, I think, for this week's episode. Thanks again to Chris, one of our patrons, for his question. Thanks to Jamie and Stuart, of course, for their epic contribution in part one. And Sam, it's been another bumper episode. We've pieced it together on Monday evening. And I think we've rolled out a banger.
I think so too. And we've managed to do it in under 2 hours, which is incredible for us. So, yeah, well done to everyone involved. And, yeah, thanks again. It was a really interesting week. And, next week looks fascinating as well. If there's any call for it, I'll do a bit of a write-up of the two games in midweek. I think they're both very interesting matches. So, and then a little bit of a what in the world has happened in the Louvain Cup, because we tend to ignore it on this podcast. But the group stage is thankfully wrapping up this midweek, and we can get into the playoff fixtures, and which are a lot more exciting.
All right, so terrific stuff again. Sam, thanks again for all your work on this week's episode. And that's it, listeners. Once again, thanks to all our patrons for their ongoing support. If you'd like to get involved, please visit patreon.com/jtalkpod. And listeners, thanks again, as always, for listening wherever you are. We'll be back next week to round up J1 Match Day 14. Speak to you next week. Bye for now.
The J Talk Podcast.